to see everybody that's here. This is Friday night, which means it's time for preacher thank yous. So I appreciate all that you've done for us this week. It's been so good to be able to be back with this congregation. This church means a lot to us, means a lot to our family, and we're very grateful for all that you've done and welcoming us back, just kind of like we never left, it feels like. I remember when I was here, people telling me that once you are one of the summer boys, that you're always part of the congregation here. And having come back this week, I really feel like that's true. And I think that you're to be commended for that. So thank you so much for being a part of our lives, for continuing to be a part of this our lives. And we just think that a lot of this church. I do have to admit that it was kind of intimidating coming back here. The last 4 years or so, I've been with rather smaller churches and smaller venues. I worked a little bit with the church in Auburn, which was a larger group, not as big as this congregation, though, and then I came here and preached for a while. And then after that, it was smaller places. And so coming back here, it was kind of overwhelming at first. Just how many pews there are, I guess. If I look over here, then I'm talking, somebody's looking at my back over here, and so I had to get readjusted to all of that. But it didn't take me very long to feel like I was back home again, and we just had a really good week. There's a lot of people here who are very encouraging. There's a handful of people who have always really lifted me up a lot and encouraged me so much that first summer that I came through here. And I still remember verbatim, word for word, some of the things that people had to say, some of the encouraging, uplifting things. And those sorts of things stick with you for a while. And I thank you for that. I think God gives some people the gift, the ability of being an encourager. And I feel like there's some of those people here. And so just keep on encouraging. I encourage you to encourage. And I'd also say that it has really been a good audience, a great audience this week. I think any halfway decent speaker, and I guess I consider myself a halfway decent speaker, maybe one day I'll be all the way decent, but I think any halfway decent speaker knows when his audience is paying attention, and if they're following, and if they're engaged, and I can definitely say that you have been. You've been great listeners. Very involved in what we've been talking about, very engaged, very interested. Everybody's been following along, and it's been very obvious to me that you want to be here and that you want to learn, and so thank you for that. As a kid, I remember going to gospel meetings, and we had a beige Ford Aerostar minivan. So after the service was over this one night, I went out to the parking lot to find the Ford Aerostar minivan. I walked out in the parking lot. I saw the beige van, and there was somebody sitting in the driver's seat. And so I opened up the passenger door. I sat down in the passenger seat, sat there for a few minutes, maybe not a few minutes, but a little while. And then I looked over, and I saw somebody that I had never seen before in my life. And it turns out there were two beige Ford Aerostar minivans in the parking lot that night, and I sat with somebody for a little bit, thinking that they were somebody that they weren't. And sometimes it may be that somebody isn't who we think that they are. And it may be that sometimes in our lives, we're not quite who we think that we are. So I want to pose the question tonight, who are you? Who are you? And we're going to consider that question as we look at the trials and crucifixion of Jesus, which is our text for this evening. Last night, before we get to Luke, last night we left off in the garden. It's that night in the Garden of Gethsemane. All the disciples have fled. All the disciples are gone. John then picks up the story and gives us some more information about that evening that we don't have in the other Gospels. We learn from John that from there he then goes to Annas, which is in John 18. 18, verse 24. So the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. First they led him to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. It was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. Then, as we read on, he then goes to Caiaphas in verse 24. Annas then sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Well, we know it's been daybreak, and so now we're going to go to our text for tonight that the VBS has assigned. We're going to look at the latter part of Luke 22 and then move our way through Luke 23. So those couple of verses in John kind of fill in a little gap that exists in the other Gospels. So you've got the Garden of Gethsemane, and then he goes to these two individuals. Well, now sun comes up, and we're over in Luke. And he goes before the Sanhedrin in Luke 22. Luke 22, let's begin in verse 66. When day came, the assembly of the elders of the people gathered together, both chief priests and scribes. Now, sometimes in your Bible, you may read something similar to this, that there's the chief priests, scribes, elders, some sort of terminology like that. And so then you've probably got the council that's gathered together there. They led him away to their council, and they said, "If you are the Christ, tell us." But he said to them, "If I tell you, you will not believe, and if I ask you, you will not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man shall be seated at the right hand of the power of God." So they all said, "Are you the Son of God then?" And he said to them, "You say that I am." Then they said, "What further testimony do we need? We have heard it ourselves from his own lips." This is governing body of the Jews. They had smaller courts, but then they also had the big courts, kind of like our legal system, maybe a little bit. You've got smaller courts, then you've got a larger court. And it's been said Pharisees influenced the Sanhedrin policy quite heavily. Just like today, you've got different parties and kind of subgroups within those parties that can be very influential in policy making and such. And well, they say the Pharisees are quite influential in the Sanhedrin. We don't know very much about their proceedings and how typically all these things would go down, either from Scripture or from secular writings. We do know, though, a little more about some of the smaller courts. And it could be that the smaller courts were run in a similar fashion as was the big courts. And what we know from some writings about the smaller courts of the time is that typically they would sit in a semicircle, and on the ends of the semicircle, there would be people taking notes, taking the minutes, you might say, of what's going on. And you'd have a plaintiff and a defendant and people arguing the case. You might have some eyewitnesses that would come forward. It's still probably a pretty similar scene to what you have today in a courtroom. It may have been much the same as far as some of the proceedings would go. But as we look at this gathering, you don't see any of that going on. You don't really see any sort of real proceeding, no real eyewitnesses with any sort of a structure, no plaintiff, no real defendant arguing a case or that sort of a thing taking place. They just had a question for Jesus. Are you the Son of God? That's their question. The whole thing is based on. And Jesus knows full well what this question means. And he knows full well the implications of his answer to this question. In a sense, all of us, each one, is a son of God. We're all children of God. But they want to know, are you the Son of God? And he knows what this question means. And he knows what his answer is going to mean. And, of course, he answers affirmatively that he is the Son of God. Well, who are you? Maybe there's some who are like the Sanhedrin. Maybe there's some who haven't really given Jesus a fair trial, if you will, in their life. Maybe they haven't really examined the evidence. Maybe they really haven't sought out to find all the evidence that they can. And because of that, they reached conclusion about him that isn't necessarily true as far as their own investigation of him goes. So who are you? Maybe they're someone like the Sanhedrin. Really haven't looked very carefully. Okay, kind of been haphazard about the whole thing. Well, who are you? Maybe there's some who are kind of like Pilate. As we continue reading on here, the next scene is as he comes before Pilate, picking up in chapter 23. And the whole company of them arose, and if this is talking about the whole company of the council, some have said that there's usually about 70 or so gathered there. So it may be that this huge crowd now brings Jesus before Pilate. And they begin to accuse him, saying, "We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar." Now, really, that is not what they are concerned about. It seems that they are just trying to find something that's going to upset Pilate, something that's going to turn Pilate about this person, against this person, Jesus. And so whatever it is that they can say about him, that's what they're going to say. So they say, "He misleads the nation. And he tells us not to pay our taxes, not to give tribute to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king." And Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answered him, "You have said so." And Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, "I find no guilt in this man." But they were urgent, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, from Galilee even to this place." And let's skip on down to verse 13, and we'll come back and look at Herod in a minute. If you skip down to verse 13, he's with Pilate again. Pilate then called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people and said to them, "You brought me this man as one who is misleading the people. And after examining him before you, behold, I did not find this man guilty of any of your charges against him. Neither did Herod, for he sent him back to us. Look, nothing deserving death has been done by him. I will therefore punish and release him." But they all cried out together, "Away with this man, and release to us Barabbas, a man who had been thrown into prison for an insurrection started in the city and for murder." Pilate addressed them once more, desiring to release Jesus. But they kept shouting, "Crucify, crucify him." The third time he said to them, "Why, what evil has he done? I found in him no guilt deserving death. I'll therefore punish and release him." But they were urgent, demanding with loud cries that he should be crucified, and their voices prevailed. So Pilate decided that their demand should be granted. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, for whom they asked, but he delivered Jesus over to their will. We don't know too much about what happens to, or in regards to Pilate after this. There's some early church writings that make Pilate out to be a pretty good guy and even a member of the church. There's others, though, that make him out to be an enemy of the church, and so we really don't know. But I think that what we do know here is what we have is a man who seems to have some convictions, and yet he's not acting out on those convictions that he has. Who are you? And there's some who are like, you've got some conviction about something, you believe something, but because of pressure of the crowds, because of pressure of people around you, maybe just a person around you, you're not really willing to take that step and not really willing to take a stand for what it is that you think is right. I think there's probably a lot of Pilates in the world. I think there may be a lot of Pilates in the scientific community. I think there's probably quite a few who realize the rational arguments for a God, for an intelligence designer. But they know that if they were to fully embrace that, that there's pressure and that there would be consequences. There's probably lots of pilots on job sites. Maybe you have a conviction, but because of something with your coworkers or maybe something that your boss wants you to do, you don't quite take that stand that you should. And there's probably lots of pilots in homes. Husbands who don't take a particular stand on something they believe because maybe of something the wife believes or the children believe, or a wife who won't because of the husband or the children, or the children who won't because the parents are going to disown them if they did. And there's stories like that. And there's all sorts of scenarios that you could paint. And I imagine there's probably lots of pilots in many churches. People who have heard sermon after sermon, Bible class after Bible class, been service, and you have a conviction, you have a belief, yet you're not quite willing to step out and take that step and act on that conviction. Maybe because of some pressure that's around us. Who are you? Maybe there's some like pilots. I don't know when Herod came up here, but Herod is the next one we have. And Luke 23 and verse 6. So now we're going to go backwards a little bit. We've looked at Pilate. He goes to Pilate and then back to Pilate. In the middle of that, he is with Herod in the beginning of verse 6. When Pilate heard this, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. And when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him over to Herod, who was himself in Jerusalem at that time. When Herod saw Jesus, he was very glad, for he had long desired to see him, because he had heard about him, and he was hoping to see some sign done by him. So he questioned him at some length, but he made no answer. Chief priests and the scribes stood by, vehemently accusing him. And Herod, with his soldiers, treated him with contempt and mocked him. Then, arraying him in splendid clothing, he sent him back to Pilate. And Herod and Pilate became friends with each other that very day, for before this they had been at enmity with each other. So far in the text, there's kind of an escalation that's going on here. He's before the council, then he's before Pilate, now he goes to Herod. And Herod wants to see Jesus, but it appears that he wants to see Jesus so that he can see a trick, so that he can see a good show, so that he can see a sign, as we read there in verse 8. He's hoping to see some sign done by him. So he wants Jesus to come in and maybe put on a good show. Just do a trick. Show me what you can do. Who are you? Maybe there's some who are kind of like Herod. We want Jesus to come in and maybe show us that he can do something, maybe fix some problem, but then we're fine if he goes out and if he leaves. Jesus is not the great magician. Jesus is the great physician. There's a good difference between those two things. Some people kind of treat Jesus like he's a great magician. He can come into our lives, he can do some nice trick, he can fix something, but then, just let me do my own thing, that's all I wanted to see. But he's not the great magician, he's the great physician. And he wants to be a part of our lives, he wants to fully and truly heal us, he wants to change us, he wants to transform us. And if our idea of Jesus is just having him come into our lives when we're in trouble and maybe having him do some trick in our life, well, then that's no relationship at all. Who are you? Maybe there's some who are kind of like Herod. Next, we move to the daughters of Jerusalem. It says, are weeping, mourning, lamenting. We're not going to read all the verses of this chapter, but 23-27 is the next one that I want to look at. 23-27. And there followed him a great multitude of the people and of women who were mourning and lamenting for him. Who are you in this story? Is there anything about these people that's in you? Is there any emotional response within you as you think about Christ going to the cross and what it is that he's going to suffer? Does that produce anything in us? When we were at the church in Pensacola, there was a young boy there, and I wasn't aware of this, but Elise told me that when the Lord's Supper was passed through, he was in kindergarten, I believe, but when the Lord's Supper was passed through and they had made some remarks about Jesus dying and what he went through, that this young boy would tear up and become emotional. As he thought about this nice man, Jesus, that he's read about and he's heard about, and then as he thought about the mean people and what they were doing to this Jesus, that he as a child, as he thought about those things, it produced a response within him. I've had many situations where we could probably learn a lot from children. As we think about Christ going to the cross and what he went through and what the bad people did to him, does that produce anything in us? Or is it just another thing that we do? And I'm yourself. You take a pinch of the cracker, you take a sip of the juice, and you mark that off as something you've done this Sunday. There should be so much more to us than just that. As we think about his death and what he went through, does it produce anything within us? Who are you? Maybe there's some who are like the soldiers and the rulers. In verses 23, chapter 23, verses 35 through 38. Maybe there's some who, as they think about the cross, it's just something that they mock, something that's laughed at. And the people stood by watching, but the rulers scoffed at him, saying, "He saved others, let him save himself. If he is the Christ of God, his chosen one." Soldiers also mocked him, coming up and offering him sour wine, and saying, "If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself." There was also an inscription over him, "This is the King of the Jews." And I don't know if we have anyone here tonight that's like the soldiers and the rulers, who, as you think about the cross, as you look at the cross, it's you as just something worthy of being mocked, something to just laugh about. I don't know that we have anybody like that here tonight. Maybe we do. I don't know. But if that's your situation, I'd encourage you to just keep looking a little bit longer. Stay at the cross a little longer. Look at the cross a little bit longer. Think about the cross a little bit longer. And it may be that one day you say, "Truly, this was the Son of God." Over in Mark's Gospel, it says that those are the words of the centurion. And it seems that there's a very good chance that he would be one of these soldiers who's at the cross mocking. But as he stays at the cross a little bit longer and looks at this Jesus a little bit longer, eventually he arrives at the conclusion, "Truly, this was the Son of God." Who are you? Maybe there's some who you may be like a thief on the cross. Luke 23, and beginning in verse 39. One of the criminals who were hanged railed at him, saying, "Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us." But the other rebuked him, saying, "Do you not fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we are receiving the due reward of our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong." And he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And he said to him, "Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise." Here's a man that before his death, he acknowledged who this Jesus was. And I've heard some speak of those who convert later in life, or maybe even shortly before their death, in almost kind of negative terms. As if to say, "You've done all these things wrong for so many years, why now? Why now are you going to turn? Is that really sincere? Why now are you doing that when you're up in age?" And I kind of heard that sentiment expressed by some. But I would much rather have somebody obey later in life than not obey at all. There was a story I heard about a man in Birmingham. And he was in the hospital. He was very sick. And they hadn't given him very much time to live. His children were Christians. His sons were Christians. And they had talked with him so much through the years. And he just never would accept it. He just never would obey. And as he was in that hospital, he knew what the truth was. He knew what he needed to do that he hadn't done. And he decided that he was going to be baptized. Well, I don't remember what day it was or what time they said it was, but for whatever reason, everything is pretty much locked down. It was a hospital on a university campus. And there's a pool somewhere that they could use, but because of the day or the hour, there's nothing open. And so they're thinking, well, all these years we have tried, and now he has accepted it, and we're not going to be able to do this. And about that same time, there came around a janitor who happened to have a key for the room where there was a pool. Sometimes there's some strange things that happen. But they took him and they baptized him, and a short time after that, he passed away. God must
much rather have somebody obey late in life than not obey at all. Maybe there's some who are like the thief on the cross, or maybe need to be like the thief on the cross. Who are you? Maybe in here, and perhaps most of us in here in one way or another, are most like Joseph and the women. They honor Jesus, they revere Jesus, they respect Jesus. In Luke 23 and beginning verse 50. Now there's a man named Joseph from the Jewish town of Arimathea. He was a member of the council, a good and righteous man, who had not consented to their decision and action, and he was looking for the kingdom of God. This man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus, and he took it down and wrapped it in a linen shroud and laid him in a tomb cut in stone, where no one had ever yet been laid. It was the day of preparation, and the Sabbath was beginning. The women who had come with him from Galilee followed and saw the tomb and how his body was laid. And they returned and prepared spices and ointments. On the Sabbath day, they rested according to the commandment. These are people who honor Jesus, who respect Jesus, who give him the proper honor and admiration. And maybe as we think about all these characters in this story and who we are, maybe we see a little bit of ourselves in Joseph and the women if we say that we can honor him, we respect him. Well, who are you? We've looked at lots of different people, lots of different characters that emerge in this story. We've got the Sanhedrin, there's Pilate, there's Herod, there's the soldiers and rulers at the cross, there's the thief on the cross, and there's Joseph and the women. Who are you? Well, there's one more character that we really haven't given much thought to. And it's that character that hopefully as we think about ourselves and who we are, that we can see a little bit of him in us, and that's Christ. As we read through all these characters and we ask the question, who are you? The one that ultimately we should strive to be like is Christ. And if we do that, then as we pass from this life, we can have peace. And we can pray, I believe, in a similar manner, maybe not in the same context, but in maybe a similar way, we can pray as Jesus did, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. If we in our lives have looked at ourselves and asked the question, who am I? And we have made all the effort that we can to be like Christ. That as we say, who am I? If we can say in one way or another, I have tried my best to be like him and let him live within me. Then we can greet our final words and say, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Who are you in this story? Lots of different characters, lots of different responses to Christ. But ultimately, it's Christ himself that this story is about. It's Christ himself that this book is about. And it's Christ himself that our lives should be about. So if we can help you in any way at all, get closer to him. Confess his name. Be baptized. Maybe you've done that, but you need the prayers and help of the church. And if we can help you in any way at all, won't you please come down to the